Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Today's episode is brought to you by Plexaderm. Interesting how much discussion in the last couple of days is centered around whether or not there's going to be a Republican, a serious Republican challenger to Donald Trump. Of course, woke Joe Walsh enters the race. Everybody expects former South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford to enter the race. But the one guy who is already in the race and has been getting a little bit of traction up in New Hampshire, a fantastic profile in the Washington Post magazine over the weekend, is former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld, who rejoins us on the Bulwark Podcast. Good to have you back, Governor.
Charlie, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, let's just dive right into this to get your take on the news of the day. It feels like we're in the middle of an ongoing hurricane. The Washington Post reporting today that Donald Trump is so insistent on building that wall that he is telling aides, take the land. If you have to break environmental laws, go ahead and do it. And if you get in trouble, I will pardon you. So it's kind of the trifecta of awfulness there. So,
yeah, that's what he told Paul Manafort. It didn't work out so well for Manafort.
Yeah, it didn't. So just give me your take on this. I mean, I think the most alarming thing is this recognition, this ongoing, slow-rolling recognition of just how fragile some of our checks and balances are in our institutions, when the president of the United States can sit there and go, you know, I'm going to order American companies to get out of China. And people go, that's a joke, right? But it turns out he's got a lot of statutory powers under emergencies. Say, let's just take the land, break the law, and I will pardon you. And maybe he can get away with that, right? Or can he?
Well, yeah, no, I think the thing that looks increasingly fragile is the president's hold on reality. Although the obstruction of justice detailed in the Mueller inquiry was pretty alarming, instructing the director of national intelligence to lie, instructing his own legal counsel to file a false document, all to obstruct the investigation. That's a very clear, in fact, an overwhelming case of obstruction of justice. But the interesting part to me is that when those officials and a national security official said, no, Mr. President, we can't do that, his reaction, and why not? Because it would be a lie, it would be a false document. His reaction was, what's your point? What's your point? So what if it's a lie? And increasingly, it's clear that the president is a man who makes no demands on himself. And I think it's also clear that he has difficulty conforming his behavior to any norms whatsoever, let alone the rule of law. And I think that's starting to sink in. You know, don't hold me to the exact weeks, but I think the last 3 or 4 weeks, it's looked more and more as though the president doesn't know when the curtain is down and when the curtain is up, and he thinks he can do absolutely anything. Well, he started innocently enough with shooting someone on Fifth Avenue right after he got elected, or even during the campaign, but now he's acting that way about everything. He's a train out of control.
But he's doing this thinking I can get away with it, because so far he has gotten away with it, right? There is a sort of numbing effect to this, a normalizing effect. So we have all of these stories, and I don't think I can find a single elected Republican anywhere in the country who has expressed any alarm, who has pushed back, who's issued a statement saying, you know, really?
No, and the end game there is he's going to drag them all down to defeat. And I saw this in the case of President Nixon. I worked on that impeachment, and many, you know, reputable, honorable Republicans went through a draining effort of defending the president, President Nixon, all summer long that year. And then it turned out, the tapes became public, it turned out he'd been lying through his teeth about the Watergate cover up. And they were all defeated, roundly defeated. 1974 was probably the worst year I could think of for Republicans elected in Washington. So I think he's going to drag the party down to the point where you might even see a Democratic majority in the U.S. Senate, which otherwise would be really uphill. And when that starts seeping into the water and Republicans start realizing that, you may see something change. But until then, I agree with you. It's absolutely mystifying why all these Republicans are admiring the emperor's new clothes.
So that's the question we've been asking now for 3 years. What is the breaking point? It's obviously not the racist tweets. It's not the crazy comments. Would it be sinking poll numbers? Would that be enough? Would a shaky economy, sudden recession fears, a crash in the stock market, would that be enough to get Republican primary voters to say, we prefer Republicans over Democrats, but we don't want to give four more years to Donald Trump?
Yeah, no, I don't think it's going to be the economy. I mean, presidents like governors get too much credit for good times for both good times and bad times. They get associated with the economy, but I don't think that would tip it all by itself. I think a recognition that the president is fundamentally unable to control himself, I don't think people want that. I mean, this is the guy with his finger on the nuclear button who early on, before his bromance with President Kim of North Korea, it looked to me like he might even push the trigger on North Korea. He was so irritated that some conversation hadn't gone his way. But he really behaves in many, many matters like a child of six. And in terms of the rule of law, I've said it before, I'll say it again, he's a one-man crime wave.
Yeah, but at least we have an attorney general who's going to provide a check, right? I mean, we have the Department of Justice there as a guardrail.
Not so much. The president is relying on Bill Barr's very expansive interpretation of Article 2 of the Constitution, saying that the president quotes Bill Barr for the proposition that he can do anything he wants under Article 2 of the Constitution, because the AG says, look, if you examine why the president took an action that's facially permitted by Article 2, it's a slippery slope, and then the president could never do anything, so that must be wrong. Well, that's an argument that proves entirely too much and cannot be the law.
Well, I want to go back to the story, the story that broke today, and this will get swept away by the news cycle. But the report that the president is basically telling his aides, aggressively apply laws of eminent domain to take land, to seize land, to build this wall, even if it means I'm going to have to pardon you. But on the issue of eminent domain. I guess I'm old enough, and I guess you are old enough to remember when conservatives and Republicans thought that private property was sacred and the protection of private property was just a key element in what the Republican Party stood for. And I can still remember the moment when Donald Trump said, I love eminent domain. I'm all in on eminent domain. And that issue began bubbling to the surface. And I will tell you, I was naive enough at the time to think that maybe this will be the one that will open people's eyes about Donald Trump.
Well, I tell you, there's many ways in which he's a Republican in name only. And you know that case out of New London, Connecticut, where private property was taken to be awarded to a private developer. And that is a rallying cry for
Kilo, yeah.
property rights Republicans. So the president is not a property rights guy. He's not an economic conservative. He loves trillion-dollar deficits. His last budget, which is a multi-year budget, added $9 trillion to the deficit. So now instead of $20 trillion, we're talking about $30 trillion. He could care less about conserving the environment that sustains and nurtures and protects all of us. He wouldn't mind if there was a hole in the ozone layer 1,000 miles wide. He wouldn't understand what that means. He doesn't understand what the polar ice cap melting means. He just says, I hate all foreign countries, so I'm going to rip up all the treaties. I'm going to tell our allies to go fish. And, I'm just going to ignore the rest of the world, including the climate we live in. That's a very dangerous thing in a president of the United States. And people, I think, are starting to realize the danger element here, that the country is in danger in his hands. And, whether or not the Republicans in Congress want to come along, I think the country is going to rise up on that. And, if he winds up dragging the Republicans in Congress to defeat, they'll deserve it if they haven't done a thing by the election season in 2020.
Well, let's talk about your candidacy, because, there are critics in the Republican Party who would say, well, look, Bill Weld is not ideologically pure. He's taken positions, he's pro-choice and everything. It is interesting. We just run through a series of issues, whether it is private property deficits or trade wars, free trade, where Donald Trump certainly is not ideologically pure. But, give me a sense of the reaction that you are getting, the kind of campaign you're running. I mentioned that Washington Post article that said that you are not a take the ramparts kind of orator. And there are people who say, we need a bomb thrower. We need somebody who's going to be able to out-Trump Trump. And that's not you, Governor
Walsh. Well, that may be Joe Walsh. But I'll tell you, if Trump keeps on getting crazier and crazier, you may see me turn into a take the ramparts order, because it may be the only thing that will work. But I really do welcome competition in the Republican primary. Representative Walsh and Governor Sanford, I think, would be a great start. It would be great if we got even more candidates in there. I think John Kasich is going to take another good look at it in September, October. And I'd welcome everybody in. There would be a more robust dialogue. I think the TV networks would be hard-pressed to say we cover only Democratic debates, not Republican debates. That would raise some eyebrows in Washington, I think, in terms of fairness. I think it's a slippery road that Trump is leading the Republicans down. And I'm aghast. I've been a Republican since I was 18 years old, unlike Mr. Trump, who's been a socialite New York Palm Beach Democrat most of his life.
So you mentioned that you think that Governor Kasich is going to be looking at this again. So what is your goal in this race? Is it to win? Is it to basically be a pathfinder for others who might be able to mount a broader challenge? Or is it to ding Trump when weaken him for the general election?
No, my goal is to win. And I'll tell you what I would do. I'll give you my 100-day plan. The first thing I would do is eliminate the deficit. I had to do that when I came in as governor. I had a 16% deficit in my budget, eliminated it in a month and a half. All you need to do that is the political courage and the political will to zero out accounts that are nothing but bloated bureaucracies. I would rejoin the Paris Accords. I would make climate change a major imperative. We have to put a price on carbon. There are various models I'm looking at, including the one in British Columbia that's revenue neutral to the government. So in that sense, it's not a tax increase on the citizens. And it might have very interesting implications. We might be able to eliminate the hated gas tax if we took care of the problem of carbon some other way. I don't think the hard work is being done in Washington. We're going to lose 20% of our jobs in the next 15 years. No one's thinking about how to equip our workers with the technical skills they'll need to get the replacement high-wage jobs. I am. And I've got a plan to make that accessible to them, sort of along the lines of the GI Bill, free of charge. Not for everybody, just for the displaced workers. Trump, those should be Trump voters. Trump isn't doing anything for them. He's so wrapped up inside his own head. He's not really doing anything for anybody except exploding.
So you mentioned the deficit, and I'll ask you the same question that I asked Mark Sanford when I interviewed him last week. Look, it's obviously a crisis. You and I have spent years talking about the need for fiscal sanity, the long-term consequences of a debt crisis, intergenerational transfer of wealth. But the reality is nobody seems to care about this anymore. Nobody in Washington seems to care about this.
But okay? When I on the stump say it's crazy they do this in Washington, because everybody in this room has to balance their checkbook by the end of every month in order to put food on the table. And heads go up and down in agreement with that. That really brings it home. And there's a big disjunction between Washington and the rest of the country. Washington is mesmerized. Washington is paralyzed. But the rest of the country, voters aren't stupid. They can think for themselves. And if they see where Trump is leading us, particularly when Steve Bannon, his chief Svengali, Robespierre, political advisor, says if Trump is reelected, you're going to see 4 years of unalloyed payback. He's going to punish everybody. That's how Trump thinks.
Yeah.
Lashing out, punishing. So it's the opposite of what a president of the United States should be thinking about, how to take care of everybody in the country, not how to divide the country and get everybody all furious at each other.
You know, the piece over the weekend about your candidacy made the point that that New Hampshire has been the graveyard for a lot of incumbent presidents, that there are five presidents who really were badly damaged by challengers in the primary. I mean, going all the way back, into the 1950s. But most of the time, most of these challenges have come from the more extreme wing of their parties. You are mounting a moderate insurgency against an extremist establishment. So is a moderate insurgency a contradiction in terms?
No, I don't think so. I mean, John McCain ran as an insurgent twice here in New Hampshire, where I am now, and he won both times against all odds. He started out, you know, below 1%. The fellow who ran his campaigns is running mine, Peter Spaulding, a long-serving executive counselor, veteran of New Hampshire Republican politics, almost synonymous with New Hampshire Republican politics. I get a lot of traction on the ground here when I say to audiences, including Democrats, if you are not satisfied with what Mr. Trump is doing in Washington, you can vote against him twice. Come on in and vote in the Republican primary for me. That's a vote against Trump. I assure you that vote is coming right out of his hide. And then you can vote again in the final for whoever you want after the Democrats have selected their nominee. That gets a lot of traction among not just unaffiliateds, but among Democrats. And of course, as you know, Charlie, in New Hampshire, like Massachusetts, Vermont, 20 states in all, unaffiliated or independent voters can vote in either primary. And that's how I got elected every time in Massachusetts. The Republicans would be kind of a draw, and the independents would come in and vote for me 6-1 in the primary. So I won sometimes by a lot with those independent voters.
And there's an interesting history lesson there. I mean, I've been focused on what happened back in 1968 when Eugene McCarthy stepped in to run against Lyndon Johnson, and nobody else very, very much, you know, like feels like this time, you know, none of the ever other more plausible candidates like, you know, Bobby Kennedy were willing to get into the race. Eugene McCarthy gets into the race. He does extraordinarily well in New Hampshire. That ends Lyndon Johnson. But you've been telling the story that there's a pattern here. I mean, going back to 1952 when Estes Kefauver beat Harry Truman in the Democratic primary. I had completely forgotten about that.
Truman dropped out.
Lyndon Johnson, obviously, in 1968. Gerald Ford in 1976, when Ronald Reagan ran against him and did very well. Jimmy Carter in 1980, when Teddy Kennedy challenged him. George H.W. Bush was clearly dinged by Pat Buchanan. So these cases would indicate how significant even a losing effort against an incumbent president might be in New Hampshire.
Yeah, but I'll tell you, my aim is to win it. And let's say I win the New Hampshire primary against all odds. I think that might even knock Trump out because it's never happened before. But that is our aim. If that happens and then someone else gets in, a Republican who's been going around the country introducing Donald Trump as the savior of the United States for the previous 15 months, I'm not going to let him get away with that. You know, I'm no shrinking violet. I was head of the criminal division, the Justice Department, and I'm going to point out exactly how they've been introducing him at rallies and stuff. And that doesn't even have to be a 30-second spot. That can be a 10-second spot. And it'll show what they were made of last year and the year before. And I'll ask voters, do you really think they've had a personality transplant because I won the New Hampshire primary? So that would be an interesting campaign.
Yes.
And maybe you'll see the Take the Ramparts Bill Weldon, that campaign.
Well, let me ask you,
maybe sooner than that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the whole Joe Walsh thing is he's gonna punch Donald Trump in the face. He's gonna make it a bar fight. Whereas there's a great line in this this WAPO piece that says that, you know, that you use, you know, sophisticated language, and they say cerebral courtliness is not, to put it mildly, the dominant mode in Republican politics at the moment, which is certainly true.
Yeah, so, I think people can understand what I'm saying, I think.
Yeah, people can understand what you're saying. Well, let's go back to your critique and what you're saying about the president, because this does feel like an extraordinary moment. And also, I think an interesting moment for members of the libertarian wing of the Republican Party who, I have to say, many of their critiques seem a lot more plausible to me over the last several years. We're talking with Governor Bill Weld. But let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. Okay, picture your face in the mirror. Do you see all those wrinkles around your eyes? How about the crow's feet or those large under-eye bags? Now imagine they're gone. I'm not talking about some risky, expensive surgery. Just gone in minutes. It's called Plexiderm, a clinically studied serum that visibly eliminates your wrinkles, crow's feet, and under-eye bags in minutes. It's the edge you've been looking for. Plexiderm can give you the confidence you'll need to be yourself at work or out with friends. And the best part is, Plexiderm goes on clear so nobody will know you're using it unless you tell them. Go to triplexiderm.com and use my code BULWARK for 50% off plus an additional $10 off. That's right, 50% off plus an additional $10 off. This offer is also available by calling 1-800-685-1292 and mentioning code word BULWARK. Plexiderm is backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. Visit triplexiderm.com today and use code BULWARK at checkout. That's triplexiderm.com. Okay, we're back with former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld, who is who has been for some time now campaigning against Donald Trump in New Hampshire. And so tell me what your crowds are like and the kind of reaction you're getting. Are you getting hardcore base Republicans? Are you getting independents? Who shows up at a Weld event? Who's wearing the Weld T-shirts?
Well, it's you don't know, of course, at an Old Home Week, which is a town fair or, public events. But everybody says, oh, yeah, no, I totally get it. I can vote against Trump twice. Sometimes it's diners. I'll shake 200 hands in three diners, and I'll get two Trump voters. So it can't be these polls that are polling what the pollsters think are the likeliest Republican primary voters. They're polling essentially the Republican State Committee and people who are longtime activists in the Republican Party. By and large, they're never going to be for me. My job is to enlarge that electorate beyond them, beyond the Republican Party bosses. And when I say that, everyone agrees with that. And obviously, as you pointed out earlier, Charlie, there's an element of intergenerational unfairness in Trump's policies, both the deficit and climate change, and the millennials are getting murdered. They'll never see Social Security, and they know it. So, last time 49% of millennials voted. Let's say hypothetically that went to 70% this time because millennials decided that they really didn't want four more years of Donald Trump. They are so numerous. They're the largest voting bloc now that President Donald Trump would not win a single primary if millennials shifted to vote in those numbers.
Okay, so we're in the midst of a trade war that seems to be escalating, massive deficits. The president is talking about seizing people's lands, all of that stuff. And yet it's only you and woke Joe Walsh challenging Donald Trump. Why has no other prominent Republicans stepped up to say, this is not the direction we think the Republican Party. What is with never Trump Republicans?
Well, I think Mark Sanford is a prominent Republican. In 2012, he was one of the early contenders for the nomination. I don't understand why everyone in Washington is so close-mouthed. All I can, and I know, at least a dozen Republican members of the Senate who I've worked with over the years, and I'm not bracing them now saying, hey, how can you still be quiet here. I'm going to wait till I get a little bit more of a following wind, and then maybe I'll start calling the issue out a little bit more pointedly than I have been doing. But, I want to lead by example here and show people that it can be done to run a rational campaign. And by the way, one that makes a lot more sense than insulting our allies and cozying up to our enemies. And a lot more sense than ripping up treaties that you know nothing about, which is what Mr. Trump does. He ripped up the Trans-Pacific Partnership because he thought it was going to be dominated by China. China wasn't even a member. This is a guy with no preparation for being president of the United States or anything even close to it. And he's not willing to make any effort to prepare himself. He's not a reader. By his own account, he doesn't listen to anybody. So he's just sitting there with his prejudices and guiding the policy of the United States. When he wakes up on the wrong side of the bed, it's another $750 billion tariff on the Chinese without rhyme or reason. He says, this is just my negotiating style. It's no way to run a railroad, much less a country.
So why do 80% plus Republicans support him?
I don't know. It's the Stockholm syndrome. We've been captured. We identify with our captor.
I use that phrase. I agree.
Yeah. It's not really rational. I think it's emotional. They thought he was the opposite of Hillary Clinton, and that's good enough for them for a long time. But if you look carefully at what he's doing, it doesn't make any sense, and it doesn't hold up. And I don't think he's going to be able to bedazzle and witch doctor everybody all the way into November of 2020. If he does, God help us all.
You mentioned the way he treats our allies and the apparent incredible water carrying for Vladimir Putin at the G7 summit.
Right.
Speaking of the G7 summit, the president seems very, very committed to having the next meeting at one of his own properties, his economically challenged golf club down in Florida. You know, in Earth 2.0, his self-dealing would be a huge scandal and issue. It barely makes the top 10. So just any thoughts about the president using his office so openly and unapologetically to enrich himself?
Yeah, you're not allowed to use your office to enrich yourself. That is criminal law 101. And at some point, somebody is going to have to tell the president, almost everything you do is a violation of the law. But, you know, you can remain in business if you're president of the United States. But using your office and official acts, and if a public statement at the G7 isn't an official act, I don't know what is. Or saying, oh, I got this troubled property at 666 in New York. I really could use a loan. This is to the Chinese within 24 hours of having official meeting with the Chinese. You know, that could be a violation of the Emoluments Clause. It could be bribery.
No, it really is striking to me that the president's self-dealing and his attempt to enrich himself and members of his family would have been a consuming scandal for any other president. And it is extraordinary how absolutely shameless it is. Isn't that really one of Donald Trump's superpowers, is a complete lack of shame?
Oh, you cannot embarrass Donald Trump. Yeah. He makes no demands on himself. That means absolutely no sense of shame whatsoever. President Nixon, rest his soul, did have a sense of shame, and it's why when the jig was up, he immediately resigned. And Donald Trump would never do that. He's too much of a malignant narcissist, not only obsessed with puffing himself up, but also with tearing others down.
And Dick
Nixon did not have that. No, this guy is 10 times more worthy of being removed from office than President Nixon ever was.
This is the point that I think George Will made about the fact that he's more dangerous because he will force us now as a society to either look the other way or accept his malfeasance, while at least Richard Nixon acknowledged his wrongdoing.
He did, and he gets credit for that. And he did it immediately, and Donald Trump will never do it. So others have to act, and it's why I've somewhat late in the game come around to the view that Congress so obviously has the duty to remove this president from office because of everything he's done and is doing and the danger he poses to our society and our country and his desire to become an autocrat, a dictator if possible, which is evident from many of his initiatives, that if Congress does nothing now, I think it's a dereliction of duty on their part.
So how do you talk about Donald Trump? Let's talk about your campaign. How do you talk about a president who last week was suggesting buying Greenland and then canceling a state visit to Denmark when the Danes said it's not for sale? Do you just laugh? I mean, how do you make that balance between it's hilarious and yet it's disturbing and outrageous?
Well, I mean, the president acts like a six-year-old all the time. Tantrums are the order of the day. And, you know, there's a lot of raw power in that office. So when the person who holds that office holds a tantrum, people kind of, you know, skitter for cover and try and get out of the way. But it's why it's a tragedy that he is so demeaned and debased the office. My hope is that he will either be removed by Congress or not returned to office in 2020. And I think if that happens, it'll be like a bad dream. I don't think the damage is going to be at all permanent. Go ahead.
Let me ask you about that, because you're talking about the vast powers that were given to the president, the presidency. Over the years, you've had Congress surrender its Article I authority, particularly when it comes to national emergencies. Libertarians have been warning about this for some time. And I think on a number of cases, we've realized, oh, my God, the president of the United States does have these unchecked, untrammeled powers that we assumed were held by the legislative branch. So even when he's gone, won't there be an imperative to try to fix those laws to restore the balance of power, the constitutional structure?
Yeah, I mean, the authority in matters of national security, that's granted by the Constitution. But, you know, the Vietnam War, for example, which many thought was an arrogation of executive power, the stage was set for that by Congress passing the so-called Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, which paved the way for Lyndon Johnson's dramatic escalation of the Vietnam War, which was a disaster. So, yeah, I think there will be efforts to rein in the excesses of Donald Trump. And it may be that it's just Donald Trump doing the things that are excessive. And it's not always because of some statutory basis. But the guy's got the nerve of a burglar, and he doesn't care how anything seems to the outside world. He marches to his own drummer, and he's turned into quite a dangerous drummer, in my view.
Yeah. But we've discovered, haven't we, that much of our constitutional legal system is based on the honor system, that we just assume that there would be honorable men and women in those positions. And when you have a dishonorable person like Donald Trump, we actually don't have firm legal protections.
Well, we do. We have a clause in the Constitution called treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. And you could construct a case against Donald Trump on any one of those three verticals: treason, bribery, and high crimes and misdemeanors. The room is so filled with smoke that you can't even see the smoking guns.
So you said that if Donald Trump leaves, the damage might not be long-lasting. But Donald Trump clearly didn't create all the problems we have. Obviously, there was a pre-existing condition. He's a symptom of all of that, the tribalism that we have, the willingness to look the other way when norms are shattered. How does America come back from that?
I think you just need to have a president who wants to take care of the entire society and who thinks that it's very important that the country be unified as opposed to divided. The current incumbent obviously think it's better for his political position if the country is sharply divided, and that itself is an abdication of duty on his part, in my view. But you just have someone who's, you know, I think of myself as a fairly relaxed person and comfortable in my own skin. And when you're comfortable in your own skin, you don't have to run off doing violently improper things all the time to satisfy the inner man or the inner beast. And I think Mr. Trump is terminally uncomfortable in his own skin. And I think that's something that Representative Walsh has twigged to, and he will help to articulate.
Do you, you mentioned before that you're welcoming more the merrier because of the possibility of a Republican debates this fall, this spring. Do you expect that to actually happen?
Oh, sure. I think there'll be Republican debates. I mean, as I say,
without
I think
Donald Trump?
Well, I'm assuming here we have an empty chair. But, you know, give me tens of millions of people watching me and a few other folks and an empty chair. I think that would be very bad for Donald Trump. But I certainly hope it happens.
So when you're out on the stump talking with real voters in real time in New Hampshire, what is the question that you get most often?
How can this be happening? Seriously. I mean, maybe there's some self-selection because it's people who agree to talk to me, but there's unanimity.
It's not a specific issue. It's just sort of like, what is happening to us?
How could this be happening? How could this be happening? Rolling their eyes, and people come up and say, "Thank you, God bless you," and they hold up, literally hold up their children and babies to be kissed. I'm a great baby kisser, so that's great with me. I'm father of eight and grandfather of nine, so when I say I want to take care of everybody, it springs from personal experience, but it's also my philosophy of government. I think the greatest good for the greatest number is not a goal that people should be embarrassed about.
So how do you answer that question? How can this be happening? Do you have an answer for it?
No, I really don't.
Okay.
the guy's a one-off. I mean, he's a complete outlier. You know, as I said, when I gave my first speech back in February saying I'm thinking about doing this, I said, I think we've reached a tipping point in our country. And there comes a time when a person has to step forward and plant a flag. And that's what I did. And that's what I've been doing. And as long as I have the breath to do so, I'm going to continue doing that right through to the end.
So are you, you know, despite the, I mean, you had this big feature in the Washington Post magazine, which I would recommend anybody go and read, but is any part of you frustrated that you haven't received more attention from either fellow Republicans or from the media?
No, you know, I've had experience in running from way behind. I was below asterisk when I started running for governor, and then I lost the state party convention and was running 35 points behind my primary opponent. And I just went out and campaigned, hit my head against the wall all summer, and my opponent pursued a Rose Garden strategy. So, you know, that was in some ways the making of candidate Bill Weld. I got the opportunity because of falling so far behind. And here, I think the fact that I have to scrap for votes in New Hampshire to get away from, you know, the party hierarchy in the Republican Party, that's a good thing. And I have to scrap for votes everywhere, independents and Democrats as well as Republicans. And I think that's actually, in the long run, going to be helpful for my candidacy.
So you're actually very much welcoming Joe Walsh and Mark Sanford into this race. I noticed that you didn't even come close to taking shots at them or talking about
their
tweets or anything.
No, nor will I. Nor will I. I think they're doing a public service by getting into the race. And I would feel the same way about John Kasich or anybody else.
Well, Governor, thank you for joining us again on the Bulwark
thank
podcast.
Thank you, Charlie.
And hope to have you back again.
It's always a relief to be in the bulwark. I wish there were more bulwarks against government overreaching and government power.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark podcast. The episode was brought to you by Plexaderm. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.